Welcome to another inspirational message from Hillsong Church, London.
Matthew chapter 5, verse 38, I'm going to read from the Message Bible. This is Jesus speaking. He says, here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So that's an old saying, which is, you know, punishment deserves, the crime fits the punishment, or the punishment fits the crime, all of that sort of stuff. That if someone does something to you, you do back to them what they did to you, the tit for tat type thing. I like the way he says, here's an old saying. He doesn't say, here's what God says, here's God's way. He just says it's an old saying, right? And he says, he goes on, he makes it, after that, he goes, is that going to get us anywhere? Question mark. Is that getting us anywhere? We could ask that same question today. Is it getting us anywhere, tit for tat? Is it getting us anywhere, strike back when we're been struck? Is it getting us anywhere? If you need any help with the answer, it's probably no. All right? He goes, so here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues you for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice servant life. Just in practice servant life. No more tit for tat stuff. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law. Now, you've got to remember this reference, familiar with the old written law. We've got to be careful here when Jesus is referring to the law that the Pharisees had imposed on people, because the Pharisees had imposed a social law on people that they leveraged their own self-righteousness and God's law to give weight to the social law that they had bought in. His reference is to what the Pharisees, which are, you go, well, what are Pharisees? What would be the equivalent today? Let's go moral police. And they don't have to have from a religious perspective, they just need to be moral police. I think this is right, this is wrong, and you should not do this, and you should do this. That's what they would have. If you're going to look for them today, that's where they would fit, and you find them everywhere. You just find them everywhere. And so he says, love your friend and the unwritten companion of hate your enemy. Well, I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring the best out in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer, and then you'll be working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. He gives his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish. To everyone, regardless, the good, the bad, the nice and the nasty. If all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, you don't expect a medal. Any run-of-the-mill sinner can do that. In a word, I'm saying, grow up, your kingdom subjects, now live like it, live out of your God-created identity. I like that. Live out of your God-created identity. Live generously, graciously towards others the way that God lives towards you. Live out of your God-created identity. When we give our lives to Jesus, the Bible tells us he restores us back to a place in God that was lost, if you read in Genesis 3, where essentially we go, well, you know, sin entered the heart of man, sin nature, all of that. And you think, well, how does that actually work out? I tend to look at it like this. We lost our identity in God. And without him, we're constantly on this treadmill of life, trying to work it out and for ourselves, do it for ourselves, or live according to our own rules, independent of God. Hence, we struggle with who am I? What's life about? What's my purpose? All of those things kick into this lost identity, But when we give our lives to Jesus, we have this renewed identity that we have to learn to live out of. That's why he's saying here, to learn to live out of it, there's a sense I've got to grow up, which means I've got to face some things. And I've got to start aligning my thinking with my God-created identity rather than my old, right? You with me, right? And so therefore you sit there and go, okay, so what is that, you know, what's this look like? There's lots of things I could probably say what it looks like. What I want to do is just take hold of a thought a little bit and just maybe just do this a little bit with it from over the last couple of weeks. And some of it, if you've been listening, you'll realize that this is, he's saying the same thing. Yeah, I know. I probably could say the same thing for the next 100 years. And it'd still be fresh and relevant. But anyway, so Colossians chapter 3. This is Paul speaking. He says, make allowances for each other's faults. Forgive anyone who offends you. Remember the Lord forgave you, so you must forgive others. Above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds us all together in perfect harmony. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, it says, tells us that God appointed people that have roles in the church with the end result is that they would be living in harmony in expression and representation of who Jesus is and what he's about, right? So this in harmony thing is important, right? But it's an end result, right? You can't sort of just arrive there. It's not an appointment. I've arrived at, I just want to be in harmony. Bang, here I am. No, there's a journey to it, right? So the message is not even going to be about harmony. It's just a fruit, right? He says, make allowances for each other's faults. In other words, Passion Translation says, be tolerant of other people's weaknesses. Accommodate other people's faults. What are faults? Weaknesses. We seem to be living in an age where we have great trouble dealing with the weakness in other people's lives. We seem to be okay with our own weakness because we get to grace it with God, and he goes, yeah, all right, in your weakness I'm made strong. And we feel good about ourselves, but we forget that we actually have to encounter other people's weakness. And that's why he says, be generous with your life, live graciously. In other words, extend grace to other people, all right? And so accommodate. Now, I think that, you know, often, you know, I've said this a few times and I'm probably saying it more and more. I try and say to people, don't ever confuse my tolerance of things in people's lives, my ability to accommodate things in people's lives what seems to be allowing things in other people's lives. I try and say, don't confuse that with my personal convictions. My personal convictions are my personal convictions, and if you were to ask me to share them with you, I'm not gonna, because that's why they're called personal convictions. All right? But one of my personal convictions is that I'll be tolerant, that I can accommodate, and I'll make allowances because I want people to get closer to Jesus. So I'm not gonna put up barriers that prevent people coming to know Jesus, all right? We should be the most tolerant people on the planet of other people's weakness. And I think we're living in an age where people are preaching tolerance. What I mean by preaching, meaning declaring it, but with this intolerance. I want you to be tolerant of me, but I don't want to be tolerant of you. Right? We've individualized tolerance. Tolerance is supposed to be something you extend towards somebody else, not something that you demand for yourself. Right, and so this thought, and so he goes on. He says, "And forgive anyone who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you, so you must forgive others." Now, What's interesting, so I like the like this, right? So if you remember, he uses the term remember. So he goes, I want you to remember something. Now, if you're reading your Bible, you don't have to go too far to say, what am I supposed to remember? Back in chapter 2, in around about verse 14, the second half of verse 13 says that God made you alive in Christ and he forgave all your sins. That this is, he says, he canceled the record of charges against us and took it away by nailing it. This is really annoying me. Anyway, that's better. It's right on the, and it doesn't matter what's going on. We're all happy now. He says, so we can all get caught up in, yeah, he nailed it to the cross and blah, 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 right? It's not blah, 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 but you get what I'm trying to say. All right. He canceled the record. He canceled the record. So whatever it is in your life, he canceled the record. So the only record that exists is the record that you hold and keep, or the record that others hold and keep against you. For other people, the only record is the record they keep, all right, or the record you hold against them. It's the only record that exists. The before God record doesn't exist because it says here that he cancelled it, right? So he says, so there's he just cancelled this this record. And then it goes on and he says, you know, you must forgive others and clothe yourselves in love, blah, and goes on. This thought of offence, all right? It is, I've been sort of looking at it for, I don't know, maybe 18 months. And when I say looking at it, I've been looking at it from the perspective of watching it play out in people's lives. If we understand, as I get into this, and for some of you it might be, he's repeating himself from 3 weeks ago, and the answer is yes, I am, all right? But if we understand, when I talk about the gospel and the power of the gospel and the message of the gospel and that the gospel's got a sound, it's got a position you take, there's a whole lot of things about it, right? In other words, it takes on a life form within your life. Well, so does offense. Offense is not a happening, right? It's not like, oh, I just got offended. No, no. If you get offended and you stay offended, it'll take on a life form. It will begin to actually become a part of who you are as a person. All right, and so it starts off, it's got a starting point where something happens that just gets at you. You're just suddenly just not happy with something because something just happened to you. I'm just not happy. I'm not happy with the situation. I'm not happy with that person. Some of the times it's something extreme that happens to us. Most of the time, it's not. Most of the time it is so small that really it should be insignificant. But because you take offense, you actually cast off all self-control and you let go of all restraint and you blow it into a massive crisis that started with a small problem. You create a crisis out of a problem. We love to swing the issues of life, all right, to extremes. We swing them to extremes. Because if we can swing them to extremes, we're excluded from the impact of the extremes. Yet I've noticed that one of the things that Jesus does, he brings everything back from extremes and brings it very close and personal. Right? That's usually the problem with Jesus. He just gets too close and personal. Even though we say, Jesus, where are you? sometimes not the prayer you want. You don't necessarily want to find him in the middle of your life when he's putting his finger on a problem. All right? So that's why, for example, the first one of the, you know, let me give you the, you know, what they say, you know, love your enemies. No, love, no. Love your friends, hate your enemies. We go, well, who's my enemy? My enemy is, well, the person that tried to run me over with a car. Person that's trying to blow me up. Person that's trying to kill me. Person that's trying to destroy my life. Now, I'm not sure about you, but I think most of us got through this week without that happening. Right? But your enemies, I remember reading, and the enemy means to someone who's pitched in attitude towards you. All right, now by the time we got through Monday, we had a bit of that going on. Pitched in attitude. Now, so it's not way out here, it's up close and personal, right? So offense, so you're not happy with. And it's usually, and I want to say this, sometimes it's usually so small that we should be embarrassed by what we blow out of proportion, right? Because what happens is you don't arrest yourself. In other words, you just don't bring about self-control. Can I say this? Most of the self-control that we've got to learn how to do and get hold of is not the acts of stupid behavior, but it's allowing our emotions to run wild and determine too many things about our lives, right? So we don't arrest ourselves. And then suddenly when we don't arrest ourselves, what happens is we completely lose perspective on the issue and everything else. Because why everything else? Because it's now becomes the thing that I view life through. This perspective that I've allowed to build, and now I see everything through that perspective. Now I'm losing perspective on so many things about life. And then where I end up is I end up in a place where I've become super sensitive about everything because I've lost perspective on everything, and I allow resentment to come in, and then we start to read everything into everything. What did you mean by that? What did she mean? When he did that, what did you mean? She didn't smile at me, when he didn't smile at me. And we'll throw away a whole relationship with God because someone didn't smile at us. Crazy. Right? Then we move into this, we move from that where now it's like ever super sensitive about everything. Because now we're starting to get quite angry about things. And we've allowed hurt to start ruling us, and we start to get very entitled. And entitled sounds like this. I'm entitled to be angry. Do you know what they, she, he did? And I'm angry about this. I'm angry. I'm hurt and I'm angry and I'm out of control. And you know what? I'm allowed to be out of control. Because I'm hurt. Someone has offended me and I'm out of control, and don't you try and rein it in, because it's actually got a sound of self-righteousness to it as well. Right? Because I'm right, you're wrong. And then suddenly what happens is the general result is, I think I'm just going to leave and go home to mum. Simple as that. I'm going to go back to, and that's what I'm saying. You have some people come in and go, I met Jesus and he set me free. I had all of this going on in my life and I don't know what happened, but he did something different to me. He did something in me and I'm different and this is amazing and they're amazing. And then someone didn't smile at you and you go, oh, God's not real. Jesus didn't do anything in my life. There's no such thing and I hate church and I'm leaving. It's like, how do you get there? But people get there. Or you just become bitter and biting. And if we're not careful, the age that we are living in, all right, is more content with defending our position and our right not to be offended than it is defending our right to have an opinion. The only opinion that we'll defend to have a right to have is our own. When we should be defending everybody's right to have a differing opinion to us on something. But we won't. We'll defend, how dare you offend me? How dare? What? Because I got a different view on something to you? That's where it's come to. And I just think that if we're not careful, the world is wearing itself out with all this sort of stuff. And our challenge is to make sure what's going on in the world is not coming in to the heart of the church. Because we're supposed to be, Matthew chapter 5, if you back it up a little bit, verse 15 says, we're supposed to be salt, we're light. Verse 15 tells us to live our lives in a way that's going to cause people to look to Jesus. We are collectively in our interactions with people supposed to bleed into society and the people around us and be different, not society and the people around us allow them to affect us in a way where we bring that into church. We're supposed to take this into the world. That's the challenge before us, right? All right. And so, if you were to look at human conflict throughout the millennia, most human conflict is based on some offense that has been magnified over decades or hundreds of years or thousands of years, and the consequence and the drama of the offended person is completely disproportional to what the original offense was. And that's what the self-justification thing. I'm entitled to make a complete disaster out of this because of this. I will to reckless abandon cause as much trouble as I can and don't care because of this. It's what happens. And I believe the churches, we are supposed to be different. We're supposed to live our lives differently to this. He says here, he says to forgive, all right? He tells us that we should forgive others how Christ forgave us, all right? Now, Matthew chapter 18, verse 22. Familiar verse. Matthew says to Peter, he goes, no, it wasn't Matthew and Peter talking, it was Peter talking to Jesus. It was in Matthew, right? And he goes, so Jesus, how many times should I forgive somebody? And you could sort of get the tone. I like to read anything. I wonder what the tone of this was. I get the feel, the sneaking suspicion is Peter is trying to work out, so how long until I'm allowed to hit them? Right, how long till I'm allowed to hit them? Because the hit back thing's important, right? That's why he says here in Matthew chapter 5, he goes, when someone slaps you, turn the other cheek. And you sit there and you go, and then what we take that because we don't fully understand it. So what do? We swing it. So when someone tries to run you over for the car, stand back up and let them do it again. When somebody punches you, just turn the other cheek and let them punch you. Well, I learned as a teenager, if you got punched once, you don't do that. Because the second one's likely to knock you out, because most fights, if you got it, you're not allowed to fight these days, but when I was a teenager, you could. But everybody knew most fights was all about one punch. One first good punch, the fight's over. Most of it was was all bravado, and then someone goes whack, bang, and the fight's over. So everyone knows you don't go like that. Because you're finished, right? But that's not what Jesus is talking about. What Jesus is talking about So this desire to hit back and just turn the other cheek, and what he was talking about, the context was, is if you were to do this and give someone a back slap, in that culture was the ultimate form of humiliation. So you could say when he humiliates someone, or he or she, when someone humiliates you, just turn the other cheek. What happens in offense most of the time? We suffer some form of humiliation, some form of lose face before others. Somehow we get in touch with our own insecurities, perhaps. There's a whole lot of things. It's a feeling that comes on you. And I've discovered more and more, this sense of I've just been humiliated, right? And so Jesus says this. He says, when someone humiliates you, just turn the other cheek and say this: you are not going to determine who I am. I'm living out of my God-created identity here. And you're not going to tell me who I am. There's only one person who tells me who I am. And that's him. I'm going to live according to who he says I am. And that's who I am as a person. So you can try and humiliate me all you like, but you're not going to affect who I am. That's a decision you have to make. You are not going to determine my behavior. There's only one person that determines my behavior, and that's Jesus. So I'm not, in other words, turn the other cheek is saying, do not give them power over you. The moment you take on offense, you are giving power to whoever it was that offended, and you have given them power to destroy your life. But you can't blame them because it's you that's doing it. You'll mess up every relationship you've got. Everything you step into will be tainted with this that you've allowed to actually begin to shape who you are as a person. Bad news, really, isn't it? But there is good news. Peter comes to him and says, well, you know, in a sense, how long till I can hit back? And then he poses another question. He goes, 7? It's like, ever wonder why he goes 7? Because it's like random number. Why not 6? Why not? Well, I would have gone for 2. All right. Why 7? Because I think Peter thought he was going to go pretty well here, because in Genesis chapter 4, which follows Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3. All right. I know, smarter than you think I am, right? Because what happens in Genesis 1, God says it's all going to happen, and bang, in Genesis 2, and he does it, and it happens. And it's all good, and it's all wonderful, and he's got man, and he's got woman, and it's all good, and it's all wonderful, and they're all happy with each other, and there's no division, and there's no problem. And then all of a sudden they go, hey, we're not really happy with the fact that God is who shapes our identity. We want to be self-determined. Then we end up in chapter 4. Start of chapter 4, one brother gets jealous of the other brother. One brother is offended at God. And what does he do? He kills his brother. Human history has just begun from Genesis chapter 4. I don't care if we've been around 1 billion years, 30 billion years. I just wish they'd decide how many we've been around. But anyway, human history has been tainted with constant, all the way through human history. Cain, who does what, who kills the brother, God makes this decree, and he says, Anyone who kills Cain in revenge for what he did to Abel, I will bring a 7-fold punishment on him. So when Peter quoted, 7? He's going, hey, I know what God did. I know what God did. So that's what he was lining up. And if you read on through Genesis chapter 4, you only have to go down another, 8 or so verses. And here's another encounter where someone declares, and he goes, if God said there's a 7-fold punishment on Cain, then if anyone tries to kill me, I will say there's a 77 time punishment that's going to come their way. Because that's what we like to do as people. We like to build on what God says. We like to distort it, and we like to set ourselves up as, hey, I've got a better standard. And it just goes on, right? So then Jesus responds to Peter and says, no, Peter, not seven, but 70 times seven. 70 times seven is, all right, it's almost, in other words, it's just infinite, Peter. It's just infinite. This has got to be a part of your life. Remember Colossians chapter 2? He cancelled all record. He can't cancel all record. You've got to, it's got to be infinite. In other words, it's got to be a part of your life. Now, then he goes on, he says, forgive it up one another. Then he goes, love. His love. Now, if someone hurts you and you're offended, have you noticed? Well, I've noticed anyway. You feel it. Have you ever noticed it? It's a feeling. But then we go, we're supposed to forgive somebody else. And what we're looking for is, how do I know when I have forgiven someone, I want the feeling of no unforgiveness. I want the feeling of no hurt. So we're looking for feeling. But forgiveness doesn't have a feeling. It's a decision you make. All right? You decide to get offended and it becomes a feeling. You decide to forgive, and he tells us how to forgive, because he tells us, he brings the next word in, which is love. Right now, if you were to look in the Bible at, you know, the definitions of love and all that sort of thing, that when he tells us to love one another, he's saying to look at each other and behave towards them with a well-meaning kindness. Love. Love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4 says this. You know, the bit that people read out at weddings, and usually nowhere else. It says, love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It doesn't demand its own way. It is not irritable. It keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins. Love never gives up, never loses faith, always helpful, and endures through every circumstance. Oh, that's why we don't read it very often, except for at the marriage vows, right? Now, have you noticed every one of those things is an outward, it's an outward thing. It's an outward expression. When we talk about God's forgiveness and God's love, it's a love that's got this incredible tension in it. For it to work towards other people, it's got this tension of forgiveness that has to be inside of it. Right? Because he says, well, anyone can love someone who's lovable. That's the easy bit. So for it to be something that marks your life, it's got to have this tension inside of it called forgiveness. Now, the interesting thing is the moment you make a decision to love, see, if we're not careful, we live in an age that says, I love you. And the reason I love you is because, if we're honest, it's because you do something for me. You give me a feeling. You make me feel good about myself. There's something about you when we look at people and go, I love you. Now, here's the problem. What happens when that stops? We go, well, I don't love you anymore. Why? Because you are not doing for me what you did, so I don't love you anymore. That's actually called using people to get what you want. All right? Love is this outward thing. But you know the funny thing is when you actually step in and you, God's love, you know what it does? Creates a new emotion. So that feeling that you're looking for to get over the offense, apologies are not going to help it. None of the them changing is not going to help it. Them doing something different is not going to help it. Them buying you a brand new house ain't going to help it. The only thing that's going to help you get this feeling that this is no longer ruining my life is I made a decision to forgive and I'm going to express myself in love towards. And suddenly, there's a whole new dimension that kicks in. So what does it look like? John 21, as worship team, as you guys come, of which I'd like to point out, I am finishing up 4 minutes and 23 seconds before my time. See, there is a God. It's my prayer for this year. God, help me, please. Anyway, so Peter in John 21, where is Peter? He's gone back fishing. What's happened to Peter? Peter has gone through the fact that Jesus said, you're going to deny me. Where did Jesus first call Peter? He was fishing. What did he say to Peter? Hey, throw down your nets on the other side and you're going to catch fish. Peter goes through this dialogue, does it, bang, they catch more fish. Then Jesus says, now come with me, I'm going to make you fishers of men. And Peter is now following Jesus. Gets to a point over X amount of time, and here you have, as Jesus looks at Peter and says, you know, sorry, dude, you realize you're going to betray me. Not once, but three times. Peter's like, that ain't going to happen. He betrayed him three times. What did Peter do? Well, Peter disappeared because you don't see him anymore. All right? He wasn't there when he was on trial. He wasn't there when he was walking down the Via Della Rosa on the way to crucifixion. He wasn't there at the feet of Jesus on the cross. He'd gone. He'd done a runner. He in himself, in his own mind probably, has taken on this sense of, I don't know, whether it be unforgiveness towards himself. There's a whole lot of things you can imagine Peter must have felt about himself and about what took place and everything like that. And so here he is, he's gone back fishing. So he's back fishing, and you imagine in John 21, when you read it, he goes, it's almost like he looks out on the seashore where he was fishing, and here's some people walking along. And one of the people that's walking along just calls out and goes, hey, Peter, throw down your nets. Peter goes, I know who that is. I know who this is. I know. And he says he jumped out of the boat. He jumped out of the boat, gets to the seashore, and Jesus greets him as if nothing had ever happened. As if nothing had ever happened. All record of Peter's wrong was completely cancelled. He greeted him as if... Jesus didn't bring it up. He didn't say, well, dude, are you going to apologize to me for denying me? I was right. You said you wouldn't, but I was right. He didn't say, yeah, oh, well, Peter, I know as I'm getting the skin ripped off my back, you were nowhere to be seen. Yeah, all the women were hanging around at the foot of the cross. Where were you, Peter? You were nowhere to be seen. But it's okay, you know, providing if you love me, you're going to feed my sheep, I'll get over it. He didn't. None of that was in there. He engaged Peter as if nothing had ever happened. That's what it looks like. And everything from that point that he expressed was love towards him. If it's good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us, hey? Jesus shows us how we should interact with the weakness of other people, the thing that we seem to find so difficult in society today. I just imagine, what could it be if the Church of Jesus Christ, if we, the simplicity of these things were just normal behavioral practice? The difference. We literally could be an oasis in what seems to be an age where every doesn't matter who you are, what's got, everybody is just at each other about all sorts of things. It's like everyone's offended all at the same time and going crazy. I think we have an opportunity to say, we've got a message that's different. We've got a God, His name is Jesus, that changes you so you don't have to live according to this behavior, but you can live out of your new God-created identity. Amen. Can we stand to our feet?
This is the end of this podcast. We hope you have been challenged and inspired. For more information about Hillsong Church London, please visit hillsong.co.uk.